All right, I'm here today with Elena Doms from Belgium. You're calling in, right? Elena grew up in the Arctic and is on a mission to protect the Arctic. I want to hear all about that story. You know, I think very few of us can imagine what it's like to grow up in the Arctic. And as I just said, you're in Belgium now, so you're on such a global journey and such a big mission. Welcome, Elena. I'm excited for this conversation.
Thank you, Julian. I'm super happy to be here and happy to tell you all about the Arctic and other exciting projects I'm working on.
Yeah, let's start right at the beginning of your life. So you were born in the Arctic. Tell anyone who's never been there, which is probably most people, me included, like how does that look, feel, and like what's your association with home?
Okay, it's a very good question, because until recently I did not realize that my childhood and my life in the Arctic was any different from what other people experienced. But when I started sharing it openly on LinkedIn and writing Arctic stories, I realized that it was. So in a nutshell, growing up in the Arctic was cold. It's a cold place. I was born right next to the Polar Circle. It was actually...
Oh, wow.
In one of the James Bond movies. So if you watch The Golden Eye, there is this very first scene with, you know, chemical weapons facility in the mountains. And of course, he defeats everyone and then he jumps off a cliff after a falling plane, and he flies inside the plane and, you know, flies away as a victor. So they say that that's my home city. In reality, that's Switzerland. My home city is flat and a bit more cheerful. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I remember it like really, really cold weather, maybe minus 25, sometimes minus 30. I remember I'm a little girl and I'm fully dressed up in several layers of clothes everywhere, including a scarf all over my face so that only eyes are visible. And we are standing in our house just before going outside. My dad would take me to school. And he was, you know, rubbing my cheeks and rubbing my nose and everything on the face, because otherwise the skin can get frozen and really hurt for days and peel off. And I remember that he was preparing me, you know, and then wrapping up. And then when I was a little girl, he would still carry me to school and tell me all the funny stories on the way. While everything would be super dark because it was polar night. So going to school and going back was always in the darkness. But there was a lot of snow and a lot of ice, so it was really, really bright when the lights reflected off of it. This for me is home.
Hmm. And it's very interesting because one of your missions, when you say, you know, like on the mission to protect the Arctic, is also because you've seen this home change like drastically over the decades, right? Do you want to share a little bit about that? Like, you know, the difference and like the visible difference that, you know, is maybe not quite as visible for most other people when you grow up in Central Europe or in North America.
That's true. The difference in the Arctic is actually quite dramatic. So I mentioned that I remember it very cold. There could be a couple of months of minus 30 degrees. And our house was standing on the river bank. And this river, it separated the city into two parts. So there are some people on the other side that have to cross the river every day to go to work or to go to school. And in summer, they can do it by boat. But in winter, they literally walk on ice. So it's around 2 kilometers. And when ice gets thick enough, it has to be around 40 centimeters. They build this road. But I mean, literally, you can drive a car on it. There are light poles on it and everything. And in the middle, ships come through. So there they break the ice every few hours and they put these small wooden pavements, and it's the closest I think you can get to walking on water, and it's pretty terrifying. But for me, I would always go to school along the riverside and I would see this road. We called it the road of life because it makes sure that people can get to work, to hospitals, get food on the other side and so on. And in December when it was in place, I knew that winter is here. But what's happening now is that the weather is very different. Now the normal temperatures in December, January are maybe minus 7 or minus 10. And actually minus 30 is considered abnormal, while 20, 30 years ago it was normal, absolutely. And sometimes temperatures even above zero. So that means the ice doesn't freeze on the river and they cannot put this road in place. And what that meant during the pandemic is that some people could not get to the hospitals. It was really difficult. Like, authorities had to be very creative, with different types of boats or aviation to get them there. And also they had difficulties with getting food. And yeah, sometimes it takes a month or 2 months longer to have this road in place. And just in my home region, which is as big as France, there are around 160, 170 roads like this, that connect villages and connect, places and people, because infrastructure in the Arctic is simply based on ice. And to give you another example, a couple of years ago, there were very known floods in Europe. And that summer, for example, in Belgium, I remember it was 20 degrees and constant rain. But in my home city, it was plus 30 for 2 months. And that was absolutely not normal. My parents, they have a small house where they were growing things, even though the Arctic is a zone of risky agriculture. And my mom said she had to water plants every morning and every evening. There was not a drop of rain, and it was absolutely not seen before. And actually, that causes a lot of consequences, right? There are a lot of tipping points in the Arctic, climate tipping points, and Arctic is warming up faster than the rest of the planet because of the climate change, but that triggers those tipping points, and that actually has effect on all of us all around the world. So it may seem very, very far away, but it impacts everyone.
It's always interesting when we can see in our lifetime kind of like the visible effect of, pollution of, what we call climate change. And this is the catalyst really for what you're creating now with Earth Plus, right? Which is an approach to really just bring the topic of clean soils and like moving soils from pollution into just basically healthy soils again. Do you mind sharing just like a little bit of the origin story of Earth Plus? Like, when did that aha moment happen when you're like, you know what? I'm going to create this, and no matter what the obstacle is, right? Because many people are at this place in their life where they're like, I wish I could just quit my job, or I wish I could just do something different, but like, where do I even start? And so how was that for you? Where was that moment in your life?
So to explain that moment, let me just explain that for the Earth Plus is not just cleaning soils. So we are working on cleaning soils or soil restoration, and removing CO2 in the process. CO2 is really, really important for climate change. Creating circular economy, all with nature. So our solutions are nature-based as well. So just wanted to clarify that it's not only the pollution we are tackling on soils, but CO2 as well. For that aha moment actually took a while. I was working for 11 years at Mastercard, and it was a fantastic experience. I loved the company, the people, and the projects, but I always felt I wanted to end up in sustainability because I was feeling the time was running out, right? I saw Arctic change. I got two little kids. I wanted to do something for the future. And at some point I was like, okay, I need to do something. And when I was back at Mastercard, I met this guy. His name is Frederik Verstraete. He's the CEO of C Biotech, and he told me about plants that he uses, about his projects. He kept me constantly updated, and I was thinking, whoa, this guy is—he's living the dream. He's doing impact. And what he explained to me is how he was building bio-based construction materials out of industrial hemp, and how he was removing CO2 on a massive scale. Now, later on, there was quite a big scandal in Belgium around a large international chemical company and Forever Chemicals pollution. And everyone knew it, and people were forbidden to go to pick up food in their gardens, to take eggs from their chickens. It was quite well known in Belgium. And Frederick was the one who took a postdoc researcher from the University of Hasselt, and together they ran a pilot last year, and they have proven for the first time that they can extract forever chemical pollution from the soil with plants. And that is quite a breakthrough, because forever chemical pollution is made to be almost indestructible. These chemicals are super useful in consumer products because they make products water resistant. But that also means they do not degrade in nature, and they only burn at 1,400 degrees. So they stay in nature, they accumulate in our bodies, and are very toxic. But it was a breakthrough to prove something like that actually plants can extract forever chemicals from soils. They used industrial hemp for that. And he was
Which is
talking
just
to.
to jump in there, which is like such a refreshing kind of piece of news, right? Like this is something we often forget that like most of the processes in nature, once we connect with some of the powers that plants have, that the earth has, that you know is in the regenerative cycle of life, like we actually are totally able to reverse a lot of the damage we've done. We just really got to get started and stop doing a lot of the you know nefarious or polluting business.
True, true. And I cannot say it's a magic pill, right? We are working on around hotspots. For the hotspots, it's traditional soil cleaning. We are working with mid and low pollution that no one wants to tackle, and because it's not economically feasible. And let me just clarify, it's not a magic pill. You cannot clean it up in 1 year or with one harvest. Depending on the pollution, it may take 10 years, it may take de decades, but this is better than inaction. We have a concrete solution. We can, with that solution, remove CO2 on massive scale as well. We have concrete products, that safe products that we can make out of it. And we are doing something better for the upcoming generations. So yes, for me, nature has amazing capabilities. Nature already surprises in so many ways. It already absorbed more CO2 than we expected it. So that's why for me it's amazing that we are turning to nature with this solution, and we are relying on nature to clean up what we have created. But coming back to that question on the aha moment, Frederick kept me updated, and I was thinking, whoa, it would be amazing to work together. And he asked me, well, can you help with the carbon credits? Because you come from the financial space, we are removing CO2 on a massive scale. So to give you an example, industrial hemp in one crop removes 3 to 4 times more CO2 than a young forest in 1 year. And in one crop, right? So if you can have several crops per year, then you can multiply those numbers. And that is amazing. It's actually in the EU Green Deal. It's in the UN, the potential of hemp for construction. And I kept thinking, and I remember I was in Amsterdam at a conference, and I heard Bojan Slat speak about the ocean cleanup. And all of a sudden, it just all makes sense. And I was like, why don't we do something like that, but for soils and CO2? Why don't we create the next ocean cleanup, but for soils? And we spoke with Frederick, and he was like, this is what I wanted. Let's do it. And we were lucky to have a Cordel Group as a partner to support us. And here we are, building the next big thing, hoping we can make global impact, hoping we can clean and restore soils all over the world. Hoping we can do something really tangible.
Yeah, this is great news. And it's also great, you know, to really get inspired by that pathway and that aha moment, you know. Again, I think a lot of people are just waiting for this moment in their life where there's like, let's just fucking go, you know? And in order to get there, you know, sometimes we have to go through frustration. Sometimes we have to go through adversity. We have to realize, okay, this is actually not filling me up anymore. What else is there I can do, right? And so there are so many causes. Tell us where the Earth Plus at? Like, what's next for you guys? What's in front of you? What are the next, you know, like what's the beginning been, but what's in front of you the next 6 to 12 months?
So we are at a very exciting moment right now. We've launched on LinkedIn officially last week. We made it open for everyone. We are at the stage where we've done the pilot. We are at the stage where now in Belgium, it stopped raining, so we can start planting in Belgium as well. So we can, restore soils here on the grounds that we have found and create materials this year. And now we are looking for pioneer sponsors and partners that would help us take our mission global, because we realize it's super lot of work to do. If you look at maps of pollution and land degradation in Europe or in the US, it's insane. Like, just 1/3 of Europe can basically be excavated. Plus, you have this news of really bad drought in Spain and Italy and other parts of the world. We can help there too, because hemp actually restores soils and uses 90% less water than any other crop. So we have got lots of work to do, and we realize that we can make global impact only if we have, you know, pioneer global partners that would support us on our mission. And that's where we are at, speaking to a lot of people, to a lot of companies, to see how we can progress and take this global. And what's next as well is we are working on building our impact dashboard and our impact platform, where we'll have, you know, global map highlighting all our projects, because we want to make sure we have full transparency of what we are doing, showcasing, you know, everything in terms of CO2 removal, reduction of pollution and soil restoration, no greenwashing, real impact. And yeah, we just had a meeting this morning on how this platform should look like, and it's very exciting.
Really cool. I want to know a little bit more about you also, Elena. I know that you're also an artist and you paint stories, you know, about the Arctic, as far as we can paint stories. How come, and like, what does that do for you and your creative and your, you know, your in your process?
Well, you know, I started really seriously painting. Of course, I drew when I was a kid, or I painted a few years ago as well, but I started really seriously painting when I was in that difficult period of, like you said, searching for a aha moment. Actually, for all pieces to come together, it took maybe more than a year. You know, sometimes I just had to get away, and painting was that for me. I took an abstract course, and I thought, well, why don't I paint something in Arctic colors, because that's where I'm from. And all of a sudden after that, I wanted to paint an iceberg. And I thought, well, why don't I share my story of growing up in the Arctic, of share the beauty of the Arctic, how amazing it is, you know, the northern lights, they are super thrilling. Why don't I share all this beauty of the Arctic through my art? And then people started reaching out, asking if they could purchase it, because they really liked it. And I thought, well, okay, why not? This can be a soft way of inspiring climate action and inspiring sustainability. And I started painting more. And actually, now I also partnered with a new foundation in Belgium. It's called Habitats, that is restoring biodiversity all over the world through different projects. And 50% of profits of all my art sales will go to nature restoration projects. So this way I can also make sure that I do my part through art as well, on sharing the story, how Arctic is beautiful, how it is changing, and what are the different things we can do to restore nature globally, because just the beauty of nature is already worth saving.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I think there's something really beautiful about, you know, your story and the way you, you know, you said you're a mother of two, you live in Belgium now, you know, you've worked with like a global company, a global corporate before, but then suddenly there was this aha moment, there was this switch, there's this like energy freed up, and you know, you're expressing yourself through art, you're a leader in business, you're driving a mission that you really believe in. You know, it's very interesting that this beauty of nature that, you know, you portray in your pictures, that's what drives you deep inside, it sounds like. But it's also that beauty of nature that takes over the beauty in your own story, in your own life, and makes it like visibly inspiring to others. Do you have rituals or ways of connecting with nature in like in your week, or with your kids, or in a way that, you know, you can share about? Because I think it's really actually essential that, even though there's lots of solutions that we need in a world full of pollution, we kind of want to get beyond just seeing the world like a spreadsheet, right? This is, I think, one of the very, very vital parts, is that what actually fills us up to regenerate the earth is to feel in love with the earth.
It's a very good question. I started working with the earth when I was a little kid. My parents got this small piece of land in the Arctic. And as I said before, it's a zone of risky agriculture, so you never know what you're going to get. Because the weather is unpredictable, but that's how I learned. I had like a very, very tiny piece of land that my parents gave within their land, and I would plant what I want there, and I would help them out with everything else. So we would grow strawberries, you know, carrots, raspberries, potatoes, and so on. And now when I'm older, we have a small garden here as well. And for example, when I need to get away, I really like to work with the ground. I think if you plant some flowers or some berries, I have special flowers in my garden, so I can make bouquets for myself of roses. By the way, the German ones are really good. And yeah, if you just work with the soil, with the ground, it's amazing. It's like some kind of sort of meditation. It really takes the stress away. Or just, walk outside and just stand on the ground with bare feet. You can maybe call it a bit of a ritual. I really like to try to experiment with different plants. And yeah, I think I have to do it more with my kids as well to reconnect with them. I found it really cool that my son brought from school a pot where they planted some beans in school, and we had to put them in our garden. So that means in schools they are starting to teach kids about nature, and I think it's really important. And yeah, we also planted some seeds for this year, and we see what comes out of that.
Yeah, really cool. Getting our hands dirty. That totally does it for me too. I was recently on my friend's farm actually. They have a beautiful, it's just a 2 acre plot of land, but it's run like a farm. And leaving my laptop and my cell phone behind and just getting dirty and getting outside of the regular kind of schedule and like not having a schedule at all just feels so tremendously healthy. You just mentioned, the education system here for a second, and I'm curious, Elena, about, being a mother specifically. You might have, like your heart might be beating exactly for this. If you could change the education system or revolutionize it, right? If you could bring in nuances that you think are just really, really vitally important, what would you do? How would you bring that evolution to the education system?
That's a very interesting one. I think educational system might be a bit on the crossroads in terms of AI coming up, and we don't know, what the jobs of the future will be. But if I could change things, I would definitely add more with nature, understanding nature. I was lucky enough that my parents had this summer house, and we spent all summers there. But sometimes I get surprised. I come in the shop and even shop assistants don't know a type of cabbage that they sell, right? They ask me what this is so they can find it in the system. And I think it's maybe not good for us that we are so much disconnected from how the food grows, because if we know how much effort is put into growing food, maybe we would have also less food waste. And we would, understand better in terms of soil nutrition. We would support soils and so on. So I would definitely do more with nature in the educational system, and I would definitely do more around sustainability, climate change, climate action, because these are, the two topics that are very close to my heart. They would not be the only ones that could be different and improved, but for me, these two are really, really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. I hear you. It is quite shocking, no, that like most people are disconnected from the way food grows. And then really I was, just starting to read a book called Letters for Young Farmers, or for a Young Farmer. It's just kind of like a connection to Rilke's, Rainer Maria Rilke's old book, like Letters for Young Poets. And it's quite interesting to see that so many of us have a love for food. People call themselves foodies or go to restaurants in big cities, but we're fundamentally disconnected from the way food grows. And doesn't mean everyone, people tuning into this podcast are probably, on average more connected to the way food grows than, the average person. But still, I think if we start with ourselves, like how often do we really question where things come from, and what does it look like to grow food, right? Because it's a real process and it's what nourishes us. I see you smiling, so I know there's lots of thoughts and opinions there. What was it like to grow food in the Arctic?
Well, in the Arctic, the season is very short, right? And next to the polar circle is actually subarctic, very close to the Arctic. So you can only start planting in June, because in May you still might still have snow and the ground would be really cold. And then around August or maybe sometimes September, you have to harvest. So you see that you have very, very short period of time where you can do something. That means that We were putting seeds in soil already from February or March in the apartment, you know, next to the windows, so that we can already put plants in the ground. Then it was a lot of nourishing, of course, so I had to take care of some plants. Some plants had to grow in the greenhouse. For example, when I tell the story of growing courgettes, for some reason people are surprised, but courgettes, they have this male flower and a female flower, and to make sure that you know, they cross-pollinate, my parents would take the male flower and would go into the female one and do it by hand. And I think in many countries it's not necessary to be done for courgettes to grow, but yeah, we did that too. So yeah, it takes a lot of nourishing. The weather is usually quite cold. There is not much snow, but still you can grow things. I remember one year was very good weather for courgettes, and we had a harvest that we could use until April next year, and we stored it at our home, and then we used it as birthday gifts for people, because you don't have a lot of food production in the Arctic. It's quite expensive, so yeah, vegetables cost a lot. And we could use it, you know, almost until the next growing season. But also in the Arctic, you don't need to just grow food. You can also pick up a lot of food from the forest. So you have boreal forests that are extremely rich and actually very important for climate as well, because we hear a lot about the Amazon, but the boreal forests store 11% of carbon in their soils. They are actually the largest terrestrial carbon sink. And they are, you know, extremely rich in biodiversity as well. And you can pick up mushrooms. So let's say end of August, September, you can pick up a lot of mushrooms, different types. Of course, you know which ones. There are poisonous ones. So you can't just go in the forest and you know, go crazy. You have to know which ones to pick. But my dad, he knew it perfectly. And we would go to gather mushrooms, and sometimes it was bags of mushrooms. Sometimes it was mushrooms, you know, I don't know, really big ones. And we would come back home and would cook them. And you can also pick up a lot of different berries, that would be cranberries, for example, that you can, or blueberries that you can eat as well from the forest.
What I love most about your share right here is just like the way, you know, it lights you up when you talk about those memories. You know, you shared a few memories earlier about the Arctic, but it's like food connects us fundamentally with the memories of our childhood, with the memories of our parents, with the memory of the people, maybe even our grandma, or grandpa, whoever made the food, right? Like these memories of doing things together, and humans most connect over a shared meal. So like, yeah, double tapping on this idea of knowing where our food comes from and getting in touch with that is probably more vital than ever, right? Especially as we're talking about soil and Earth Plus, and this idea that, you know, we want to live on a planet with healthy soils, healthy waterways. I have a follow-up question here, though, on the Arctic idea, or like the ideas around having grown up in the Arctic. So, you know, you told me earlier you went abroad as a teenager. Did you have this feeling at some point that the Arctic was like not big enough? I mean, it's pretty big, but you know, not that couldn't hold you. Like, I need to get out of here. And if so, like, what were your three favorite places in the world so far that you've gotten to travel to or you've gotten to be in?
Well, yeah, I felt that because in terms of professional career or opportunities, of course, it's much less over there. My home city is not so small. Around 350,000 people, so you have jobs there, but you know, I always wanted to do something important that would be impactful. What are my top favorite places? Well, I definitely love the Arctic because it's my home. My mom is still there. As you say, there are a lot of memories. There's still the summer house where my mom grows food with lots of strawberries. I love my home in Belgium, with my little garden with roses, that's for sure. And that's where my kids are, my husband is, and our family as well. I think it's a fantastic country to be in. It's close to everything. You can explore different countries in Europe as well that are very close to Belgium. The weather is definitely warmer here as well, although I would say sometimes even too much. And then for the third place, that's a good question.
That is a
I
very
would
funny thing you just
say
shared, though. The weather is almost too warm in Belgium. I mean, you
yes.
need to grow up in the Arctic to be able to say that. I don't know if anybody else would ever say that about Belgium, but that is really funny to me. Yeah.
It gets quite hot in here in the summer. I would say the third place that I really, really liked was Japan. When I went abroad to the US, I lived in a host family and I had a host sister from Japan. And a few years ago, we went with my husband to, explore Japan, and I loved the place.
Yeah, beautiful. I've not been to Japan yet, but or nor the Arctic, so I couldn't really tell, but this is, you're taking us around the world here for a second. Ellen, I have two more questions for you, and one of them is about, kind of the choice that all of us have to make every single day about our outlook into the world. And it's around optimism, right? And how come that you're choosing optimism every day for the state of the world and for the world you believe in, and then also how you do that. Is it something that comes easy to you, or is it something that you have like your tips and tricks? But I think the reason why I asked the question is because so many people have been continuously told to be pessimistic about planet Earth, and I think there's like a really big there's like a really big, elephant in the room there. It's like optimism and choosing that is such an important and powerful tool to do. How does that all look for you?
I think you said it all at the beginning. It's a choice, right? So it is very important to choose optimism, but I think more optimism came to me also when finally I had my aha moment and I knew what I could do. Because I think a lot of people want to do something, but they don't know how they can be impactful, or sometimes they feel they're too small to make a difference, and that it all depends on some other systems, on some other big guys or whoever it is. And they're too small to make a difference. And I was reading a book by Dr. Christian Busch, The Art and Science of Creating the Good Luck, Connecting the Dots. And here in that book, he was explaining how to cultivate that some people are more lucky and more optimistic, and how they do it. And in one sentence, he said, "Yeah, we may feel that we are not exact words, right? But the meaning was is that we may feel we are not important, we are not making difference, but actually every societal change started with individuals." And that really empowered me. Then I was like, okay, I don't have to feel powerless anymore. I don't have to feel pessimistic anymore. I can actually make a difference. And once those two kind of fell into place, it got a bit easier. And yes, I still get very upset when a new scientific report comes out and we see how bad things are. Or what really hit me was that report when the Arctic is for sure bound to be ice-free in summers. That whatever we do, it will not come back for thousands of years. And I was like, okay, this is really literally my home that is melting away. So I still get upset. And then, yeah, I have to meditate. I have to go in nature. Nature really restores me. I do cycling or walks. But then I have to get to action. I think the action is the most powerful way of cultivating this optimism. When you feel you can do something, and depending on your actions, some things can be better. And those can be even little things, but it's really important to put yourself and the attention towards the action.
Yeah, I do want to, kind of highlight one thing you said there. And it's this that we do still get upset, and we do still get frustrated, and we do still feel passionate. I think that is so important, I think it's almost dangerous how our society has evolved into this place of political correctness, or into this idea that if you can control yourself enough, then you don't have to feel all of these human emotions. Or someone who expresses passion or frustration or is disappointed is someone who hasn't yet learned how to harness all of these emotions. Now, I'm not saying it isn't important to know in which tone we communicate, or it isn't important to regulate our emotions in a way that they don't drive us. But I do think that feeling emotions is fundamentally human, and it's fundamentally important to connect with the purpose and the passion and the direction of how to apply our action in the world, right? Like, if I, you know, if I didn't feel strongly about something, why would I act at all? And I'd much rather have, you know, a society full of healthily, fully emotional people that just learn how to navigate their emotions and use them and leverage them, rather than people that are turning into robots because, you know, if something doesn't feel good, we just cancel, you know. How do you see that?
I think it's a very good point, because I do truly believe in the power of emotions. For example, specifically for love. If we love someone, we care about that person, right? We can do anything for that person. I think if we realized that type of, we had those type of emotions for nature, for example, for things around us, we would, for other people, we would realize that we're all, that Earth is our planet, that we love our planet, it's our home. We are all one. We are not a bunch of people in different countries that need to fight with each other for things. We are one. We can work together. And we are also one with nature. We are not separate from it. I think if we cultivated that emotion, we would make Earth definitely a better place, and we would restore nature everywhere, which would also be super beneficial and healthy for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, this is literally, I think, the pursuit so many people are on that, you know, tuning into the show. This is my pursuit too, is like, what does it actually take to create a healthy planet? And, you know, how can we rally and come together in ways that, you know, we can celebrate our differences, but we can also express our differences in a way that they all contribute, you know? Yeah, it's an exciting time to be alive, because it's such a dire time to be alive. What's your dream? This is kind of, you know, this is my last question. Also, the question that made me start this podcast a long while ago is like, what's your dream for the Earth, for these next generations coming in, your children, your children's children? Like, what's the dream you have, and what's the world you want to leave behind? You know, when you kind of think of your own legacy you're building.
Well, I would definitely want to see a world where we have rapidly cut our emissions. That's one, that we are, you know, fully decarbonizing, and we are on a pathway for driving the temperature back down. And I would definitely want to see a regenerated world in terms of nature, where we have nature everywhere, where there's a lot of nature in cities, outside of cities, and we are, you know, connected with it. I think it's a lot better for all of us in terms of physical and mental health. But it's, yeah, I would love to see a world. It's just also very beautiful. I think nature is amazing. It's beautiful. And that type of beautiful world where people are at peace, where we are doing, you know, a very good point, actually. It was brought by, I think, Hans Tegemann from Triodos Bank. And he was talking about us looking at, you know, constant growth. And I really connected with his message, and I think that's a very good one, because he said, if we are constantly looking at the growth of the pie, and if we take into account the externalities and the impact on nature, we would realize the pie is already shrinking, not growing. But we are all afraid of, you know, shrinking the pie, but actually it can be good for us. We could work less, restore nature, we could be healthier, we could have less obesity, we could have more family time, and actually that would mean more prosperity, not just money-wise, but more prosperity in general. And I really like that point that he made, and I thought that would be kind of world that I would love to see.
Yeah, beautiful, you know, more prosperity in the sense of true abundance, you know, joy, financial wealth, but also just abundance of access to everything. It's an interesting picture with the shrinking pie. I'll have to wrap my head around that, because, you know, there's, I think we're also like lacking to see just how much abundance there really is in the world, since the economy is kind of like a perpetuation of a lot of the same resources and a lot of the same kind of cycles, right? In the same hands of the same people, rather than understanding, like, there's probably an infinite amount of growth in front of us if we just follow the ingenuity that happened between humans and nature. But we have to come into that interface between humans and nature, where it's not just about perpetuating the same industries. I mean, if it's just about that, we're very much and very likely that pie is already shrinking. I'm totally with that idea. But well, we don't know anything about our oceans, for example, right? Like we know so little about it. We just had one of our peers, Jeremy McCain, on the podcast with the Ocean Network, and you know, it's just mind-boggling to me how many resources are in the ocean that are completely untapped because we simply don't understand them.
It is, but in my point of view, we also need to grow the pie in terms of replenishing those resources, in terms mm-hmm. of regenerating those resources, right? Not just tapping into them to exhaust them, what we have done for generations, but looking for solutions where we can bring more of them to life and support them. And for me, that would be a truly beautiful natural world we all live together in.
Brilliant. I love it, Elena. And I'm right there with you. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being on Green Planet, Blue Planet podcast, for your work in the world. And yeah, I'll make sure people can find you. What do you want to share before we wrap up here today? Is there any call to action, anything you'd like people to check out about what you're creating in the world? Maybe we'll definitely link out where people can find your art.
Well, definitely if we are looking for pioneer companies and partners for the Earth Plus mission. So if anyone wants to get in touch and have a conversation on how to clean and restore soils, remove CO2, create circular economy, please send them my way, and same for the art. If there are art lovers, Arctic lovers out there, I'll make sure to leave my information there and to share the stories behind the charts so you can get to know the Arctic a little bit better and to get the mystery behind it, because I think it's an amazing place and very different for, as you said, many people did not experience growing up there. So I would be happy to share how it feels like.
Thank you so much, Elena.
Thank you, Julian. It was really a pleasure to be here today.